Welcome to a Cult of Personality podcast. Joining us this evening is a very special guest from the country of Australia. His name is Paul Tisdell. You can find his website at spirituallife.com.au. Once again, that's spirituallife.com.au. Paul, thank you very much for joining us this evening.
It's a pleasure to be here.
It's my pleasure to speak with you, and thank you again. I've been reading your website and watching your videos for some time now, and I've been, you know, rather impressed with not just the information, but your presentation of it and your sort of manner, and that was really what prompted me to contact you. So I'd like to start by asking you if you wouldn't mind sort of talking a bit about how you got started and maybe if the awakening process that that began that for you. I think it was when it was over 20 years ago.
Yeah, there'd been times in my early life where things would happen, but you know, I just moved on. When I was in my mid-20s, I've been a surfer, an avid surfer all my life, and I had a surfing accident, surfing an offshore reef in what we call here the cyclone swell, which is a big swell. And I was taking off on a wave and something went wrong and the board came back and hit me in the head just above the nose between the eyes. And I did the death thing, you know, the go through your life, the tunnel, the discussion. And in the process of the discussion, the guy that I was talking with, gave me an offer to, come back and perform a task. Or stay there. Obviously, I chose to come back. After that, this reef was quite a distance from the rocky shoreline, and there was a deep hole between the wave activity and the shoreline. And there's really not any way you can drift from the wave activity to the shoreline. But when I woke up, I was a couple of strokes away from the shoreline, so it was easy to get in and go off to hospital and get sewn up and all the rest of the stuff. After that, a couple of things sort of happened. I became a bit clairvoyant and a couple of meditative experiences, and then that was that. I was beginning to study more seriously herbal medicine and homeopathy. And I just went on and continued to do that and continued to surf. And it was around about 7 years, maybe not to the day, but, you know, a matter of weeks from that time, I went to my first workshop on homeopathy and the like. And I'd done all the study that I'd done was all correspondence. And so this was kind of my first venture. I just sold a business 2 weeks prior, so I had enough money not to work. And at the seminar, there was a woman there who travelled from Melbourne, which this seminar was on the Sunshine Coast, which it's probably 3 days' drive, solid drive, to get to there. So she travelled all that way with this psychic lady to find someone that was supposedly going to wake up, and she was a member of the School of Philosophy in Melbourne. And, you know, I was a sort of, at that time, I had hair, so I was a bit of a dreadlock surfer that didn't really fit the part. But anyway, we were reading irises, and I sort of sometimes read them, I suppose it'd be clairvoyantly, but didn't realise that's what I was doing. And my shoulder, left shoulder, started to lock up in intense pain, and she came over and started to move her hand around, and the pain shifted with the movement of her hand with the energy, and things started to happen. And that evening, I think it was, the there was a lecture on alchemy and Kabbalah, and that was the first time that I'd ever heard the words. I was 30 at the time. And later that evening, I went through an initiation process with another person that was at the seminar. And in the morning, I spoke to her and said, what was the name of the song, as we went through part of this ceremony thing. There was a hallway, and there was a particular Bob Marley song playing, which was quite appropriate. I like Bob Marley. Anyway, she told me the song, so I figured it wasn't, you know, a total delusion. And after that, things started to accelerate, like rapidly. Over 10 days, I'd seen a heap of stuff. And I moved through a lot of changes, and it was pretty unstable for the personality. Didn't know what was going on. And at one stage, I remember looking at some Kabbalistic formulas of number, not knowing, I didn't really know anything about it, but I knew that I knew it. And it just started to make sense, and I started to unfold some of it. And after probably a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, I eventually arrived home, and I was a different person. I didn't even surf for a while, which was big for me. And I kind of struggled with the changes that were taking place, and the lady that came from Melbourne actually came and tutored me for quite a while. She flew up from Melbourne I was on the south coast of New South Wales, and stayed and looked after me. She flew me down to her place in Melbourne and basically bashed me around the ears till I got the idea of having a stiller mind. While that was happening, there was a whole heap of different sort of phenomena, I suppose you'd call it. I started to meditate, and bear in mind, before this happened, my only exposure to anything mystical besides little stuff that happened was doing a bit of yoga to try and rectify a bad back. And I'm somewhat dyslexic, so I'm not an avid reader. And I've destroyed many spellers trying to correct my writings. But anyway, there were different things that had happened, like I suppose you'd call it telepathically. I'd be hearing voices, and I kept quiet about it. Mm-hmm. And I'd have to go off into the bush to do different sort of trials. One was to sit in front of a great big black snake. And the Australian black snake, he's not as venomous as a lot of our other snakes, but when he sits up sometimes, his head will flare like a cobra. Mm. He's a very pretty snake with a red belly, and I'm not very fond of snakes. And I was told on one of these journeys to go and find a snake, and a particular snake, and sit in front of him for a while. So I traipsed off in the bush, and I had to sort of wander on blind intuition. I found this very large black snake and sat in front of it, and there was a whole heap of sort of little trials like that. And above where I lived at the time, there's a place called the Pool of Peace, which is where ley lines cross. It's a very powerful centre. And there was an old lady living there who was a famous astrologer in her circles anyway. And I think she was involved in the setup of Findhorn. And she and I used to hang out at her house, and you know, she would tutor me a bit. And at specific times, like ungodly hours, like 3 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, she'd suggest that I come up to her place and hang out. And the energy center up there is very intense. And there'd be times we'd be sitting in her lounge chair seats, and it'd be like G-forces pushing the skin back on your face, like what I'd imagine a rocket ship taking off would be like, with the energy at the end. And we'd sit there for a couple of hours getting fried.
Wow.
And does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And anyway, I'd go back and, you know, sort of get it together. And I started meditating, learning, teaching myself how to meditate, and a particular formula started to formulate off Tetragrammaton. And I only had one book, which was Manly P. Hall's, which I was reading very slowly. And this particular formula that I was working with was bringing a few results, but it wasn't quite right. And I was, had this room at the back of the garage that I used to meditate and do a bit of healing in. And this being who had a name appeared and basically said hello. It was pretty energetic. And he gave me a piece to make what I'd gathered together of this meditation practice, this piece to make it actually work. And I put it to work, and it worked. It, very energetic practice, and sort of it's alchemic in its nature. So I'd meditate for some instances up to 20 hours a day. I really like the space. And this went on for quite some months. And in that time, the meditation technique developed into a more alchemic basis, utilizing the chakras and shifting consciousness. And that actually panned out into a healing technique that I tried, and it was bloody good. The problem I had with that was that oftentimes people would get so knocked out with the energy with it that they'd be in a nice state for an hour or so, and if I had other people coming, there was, you know, they'd be sitting there. So, you know, I thought, well, this is not working out real well. And in that process, in that meditative process, I found myself reading, well, I guess, well, I don't know what an ancient Hebrew manuscript would look like, but these look like ancient Hebrew manuscripts, and I'd read them for hours, and I couldn't read Hebrew consciously if my life depended on it.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously some of it started to filter through, and I started formulating different geometric patterns of understanding the work of the material. Now, that was when I was 30. Now I'm 56, and looking back at it, the body of material, which is really quite simplistic, sort of came in reverse. If I was to put it together, or I have done, put it together and explain the meditative technique and a few of the exercises that go with it, I'd start at what came last and end at the meditation. So the meditation had all its philosophical keys that could be embodied in the practice. But it came the other way around, and sometimes, you know, ridiculously simplistically, it came together. And at one stage in all that, I read about 4 pages out of the Zohar, I think it's called a chapter, called Consuming Fire. And this particular chapter speaks about the nature of Tetragrammaton as a flame. Now, that triggered all sorts of things within me, and I started writing about it, and I eventually had to give up writing because the particular relationship between Tetragrammaton and just a simple candle flame is like a fractal. It's in everything. And, you know, it was driving me nuts. I just had to stop writing because like it was in everything. Everything I'd look at, I could see this pattern and how it worked. So fortunately, I did stop writing about it. But as a key, and it's also the meditation practice is, strangely enough, founded upon this passage. As a philosophical key, every place I applied this simple technology, it yielded results, brilliant results. Never ever failed. In the midst of all of that stuff in my early 30s, and I don't know whether we edit this piece out or not, I underwent an initiation process. Mm-hmm. It was winter time, and where I live was probably 200 yards back from the beach. And down there in the winters, we get what's called a southwesterly wind, which is bloody cold. Mm-hmm. And it was you know, full on southwesterly and cold that night. And I awoke to this being calling my name. Now, I haven't made a habit of telling this story, and it'll be obvious why not, I think. Anyway, this being was calling my name, and I woke, and he was standing robed in the sky, and he moved his finger to beckon me, and I moved at what would be the speed of light, I guess. I moved pretty fast, and I found myself at this particular place called the Pool of Peace, and in it, I suppose it would be the ethers of the place, there was a temple. And he was there with a bunch of other elders. And this guy had the same name as the meditative key, which is the name of the Redeemer. And, one could be quite deluded, because everyone has a lot of people have experiences and become the Christ and God knows what else. That's not what I'm saying here. But anyway, I underwent an initiation by him and these elders. And from there, most of the candle work and related understanding of the application of this key started to come forward. I had to work really hard on my personal conscience, my personality particularly, for it to get wound up into any delusions of grandeur and so forth. And hopefully I've succeeded, otherwise it'll be obvious I'm going nuts. But anyway, I sort of got through that. And my life circumstance changed, and I left my family and gave them the house and so forth, and journeyed with very little. And this was probably a year later. I underwent a trial where I didn't get to sleep, with the exception of about a half hour a day for 8 days. And I'd sort of go into an astral state, where I assume it was an astral state, where somebody had come along and they'd put me through a horrendous trial, so that anything that I had any emotional attachment to, I'd know I had attachment to, and it would cause enormous pain. Mm-hmm. And at that stage, I'd been studying a bit of the Golden Dawn material, and I had a little bit of a handle on how to do stuff like that, let alone I'd been, after initiation, I had access to a large amount of energy, and when I did meditation talks and stuff, the energy would meditate people, change them, and all that sort of phenomena would occur. But through this trial, there became one mantra that I clung to through the process, and it was just love. With all that stuff, I just dropped all that, and the only spark of anything that I could cling to was just the idea of love. And I hung on that, and at the end of the 8 days, the being said, "This is the last trial," and I went through it and came out the other side. I barely had my sanity, and that's when I had a car and an old surfboard, which wasn't too many possessions. And after that, there was constantly a incense that would materialize in places I was at. And a guy by the name of Sai Baba, who has somewhat of a cloud over him at present, came to me and said, you know, come over, I want to see you. I just completed what were, I think, 9 hermetic laws of what's now become the foundation stone. And I'd kind of given up, you know, I'd had enough. This, it was just getting too hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I sold the car I had. That gave me passage to go to India. And a friend of mine, who's now my wife, traveled to India with me over to see Sai Baba, and I didn't know much about Sai Baba at the time. But I went there, and on the way, I was placed in situations where I had to use the inner capacity to change things a few times just to get through the situations. As I say, I've been a surfer all my life, and I grew up surfing in pretty remote wilderness areas, which have changed now. India was quite a culture shock. All those people was a bit of a shock for me. But anyway, the first day I got there, I had this sort of a manuscript, dozen pages or so with me, and I went to what they call darshans. I got to sit in the front line, and here comes this little guy looking like Michael Jackson's dad in the yellow-orange robe walking around, and, you know, you could obviously feel that there was something going on, let alone any group hysteria of the people. There was something happening with this guy,
mm-hmm.
let alone what I'd experienced. And he came to me, and I had the manuscript under my legs. There's no way you could see it.
Mm-hmm.
And he smiled, and I sort of looked at him and went, oh, yeah. And he turned his head and turned back at me and pointed to me and said, that's mine. So I gave it to him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was encouraging, but it wasn't the end of it. A few other things happened while I was there, and then I was sent to a place in Srinagar called, I'll probably pronounce it incorrectly, but Rosabol. And this is, you know, 25, 30 years ago. And there is a tomb there. And it's the tomb of a guy they called St. Isa.
Oh.
It's been there a couple of thousand years.
Mm-hmm.
The guy was about 90 when he left the body there. And when I was there, the energy and just the presence of the thing I couldn't deny was the same as my initiator.
Right.
So that helped. After that, I got typical Indian disease and was very sick, and got home as quickly as I could, which was a wonderful relief, and slowly started compiling more and more material. And it sort of grew from there. Does that give you a bit of an understanding of how it happened?
Oh, yeah, that's amazing. Amazing.
But there was other things. There was a guy called Muktananda. And I was a surfer, so bear in mind I had no knowledge of anything. But I could surf all right. I used to get woken up at 3 o'clock in the morning when I was living on the South Coast and given lessons in regard to this meditation technique in what became known to me as Kundalini Yoga by this little Indian guy. And that was well before I'd gone to India. And I had no idea who Muktananda was or the name. And after that, little elemental, these little creatures had come and they'd give me a surf report. And, you know, off I'd go, and it worked out real good. And it was 3 to 6 months after that experience that someone handed me a magazine, and there was Muktananda, who died, I think, 18 months prior or sometime prior to that. So he wasn't all that dead in my dreams. Mm-hmm. And you know, a lot of material happened through that sort of dreaming process and meditation process. So where do we go from here?
Wow, that's amazing. Let me just collect myself here. This is a fascinating story. So from sort of that point, you began, you know, putting together material. One of the things I noticed from your website is the artwork. Was that in this period too, or did that come later?
I did a lot of things in artwork, as like archetypal drawings to hold information, mm-hmm. and then I could come back later and unfold them. Now, I'm a terrible artist. My wife won't even let me have a paintbrush to paint the house because I make such a mess. So you can imagine what the artwork was like. For a time, when I first moved up to where I am now in the North Coast with a couple other guys and my wife who were artists, and they all got together and painted a heap of paintings containing what I asked them to, containing information. Mm-hmm. And another friend who I'd helped in Western Australia come over to live here for a while, and he got me involved in computers and video editing. And prior to that, another guy that I met gave me some money to actually buy a video camera, and at those days it was all analog, and I started to play around with that and develop some analog videos. And when I got onto digital stuff, I found that what happened when I would start working was there'd be points in transitions that there would be one image, and that one image just contained volumes. So I got pretty turned on by video or DVD. DVD didn't even exist in that stage. Mm-hmm. But I got really turned on by the process, because from an archetypal point, I didn't have to say anything. The image held it all. And there's just so many images. So now I've come back to a lot of that work now and start to unfold the odd frame here and there. And it's just so dynamic. I love it. Again, bear in mind, that I'm a bit dyslexic, so I don't read manuals. I just have to trip over things. And, these things, sort of miraculously, made me trip over in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So I'm somewhat reluctant. I've always been sort of quite a recluse and somewhat reluctant to give a lot of the material out. Not that I don't think people appreciate it. One of the hard lessons that I've had belted around the years and continuing is pearls before swine. Mm-hmm. And I say that respectfully, you know, I don't think that people are swines, but you understand what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
That most of it is all of it, the real important part of anything is just simple. And the intellect just doesn't want to know about simplicity. It wants something to be grand and glamorous, and so it can grab around it and be, make itself really important from that point, and the simplicity just destroys that. So it's been a struggle for many years, whether I put anything out or whether I don't put anything out, not wanting to have it shit on.
Right.
You know, I hold it in the highest esteem, and I don't expect anyone to take the material and hold it in grandeur. It is unto itself. If it works, that's fine. But you know, it's just a thing that's been really stressed on me as I've gone through the process of being able to deliver it, and that's all about timing. You know what I'm saying there?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely do. Now, with the experiences that you had from the incident when you were surfing all the way through to, you know, all of these amazing experiences, I imagine you really felt sort of a sacred obligation. You were compelled to really bring this material to those who were seeking it. Is that right?
Well, I was driven more in actually compiling the material and putting it together. I hadn't actually got a great awareness of putting it out for further than getting it down. Like, I suppose 20-odd years or even longer, it was almost furiously working away at it and putting it down, testing it all. You know, I learned homeopathy and so forth, and one of the disciplines there was about actually testing, if you made a medicine, to test it on yourself and see what happens. Mm-hmm. So I tested everything I could in every possible way that I could to make sure that, you know, it did what it did. And at the same token, I was in the process of growing and still am. So it was growing, for me, it was growing me more than anything else. And even passing it on to anyone really enhanced my understanding of it. I'm sure anyone that has done that, when you start telling someone else about it, you gain greater insight and a deeper understanding. You give something away and you get something, eh?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, putting it out in the world is kind of the last aspect of it, I suppose, and it's only been, I've had the website going, I don't know, a few years now, but it's certainly not my main, you know, my love is actually getting down there and doing it, and after that, I kind of move on to the next thing, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time in our position of humanity, I think from what's happening recently, how things are moving, it's high time that some of this simple exercise, like a lot of people are putting it out, but these meditative exercises and the simple technology of how the flame works through things gets out there and gets used, gets put into practice. When I was a young guy, I used to have this reoccurring dream, and it continued until such times as I started to study herbal medicine, and then it only reoccurred a couple of times. And it was about a time when there were severe environmental problems and all sorts of shit came down, and I was, you know, probably maybe another 5 years or so older than I am now, if I recall. Now, I'm not much into being a doomsday person, and it's certainly not doomsday, but as a humanity where the only thing that's going to make any difference in regards to where we're going with our environment and all the rest of it is a change in consciousness. Nothing, you know, no technology is going to do it, because from where I sit, the basic problem is greed.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that's going to change greed is consciousness.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Completely. Without the change in consciousness, I don't see how it's possible to really change the situation that we're faced with and now and going forward. Now, you mentioned the flame, and this is, and you talk about this, this is the light of the Kabbalah, the transmutative flame of alchemy, and if you wouldn't mind, sort of briefly, just for those people who may not be familiar, sort of touch upon how this this fire within can transform us.
Firstly, if you look at a flame, a simple candle flame, what you'll see is subtly there's four divisions. There's a burning wick, and there's a blue-black flame that comes down below the wick and rises up above it, like in a teardrop shape. Sitting on top of that is the white light, and above that is an all-encompassing flame. Now, if you just consider the nature of a flame, what it represents to us, you know, one, it's light. It transmutes matter to the energy of light. The flame represents love, truth, and life. Because the flame is alive. You know, you touch it and you'll find out it's alive. It'll burn you.
Oh, yeah.
So, that in itself is, for me anyway, it's huge. When you consider that this thing not only represents life, but it is alive. It's what we say in innocence about the flame of the heart, love, and the fire and all that sort of stuff. It's what we say naturally. And one of the things I've learned from Kabbalah is the purest form of Kabbalah is archetypes. And the purest form of archetypes are those which appear naturally of their own accord. That's probably the only real archetype there is anyway, for that matter. And the flame is that dynamic archetype. Tetragrammaton, or Yod Heh Vav Heh, when the letters are placed on top of one another with Yod on the top, creates the pictogram of man, or man and woman, not to be sexist. And that's an archetypal form. That's the basic pattern that we're created in. Each of those letters relates to a part of the flame. The Yod is the all-encompassing flame right at the top. The Hay is the light above. The Vor is the blue-black flame. And the Hay below is the burning upon the wick. Now, Hay is the number five. And we have five above and five below. The above is the white light, and the below is the burning wick. You got that in your mind?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and Vor, which is six, which represents the unity of above and below,
right,
is between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Hay is also means life force. So we have life above and life below. Life above is, we can call it a palace of light, heaven. Life below is a hot burning wick, or inferno, or hell. So we have the analogy of heaven and hell in the flame, and actually explains it brilliantly. The burning wick is our instinctual aspect of consciousness, and it fits in the sacrum, the yesodic area of one's being. The martial artists rather call it the tungeon, where it's the foundation of all martial arts moves. That all, everything comes from the core there.
Mm-hmm.
When our point of attention or our awareness is focused within our instinctual nature, we instinctually fear. We're instinctually in survival mode and all the rest of the stuff. Now, there's not much peace there. You know, whenever you get caught in any of that stuff, it's bloody hellish.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the flame above is our higher aspirations. It's our spirituality. It's the purpose of the flame to begin with. So if we seek to aspire to the light, if we seek to our higher aspirations, how do we find it? So if we go back to the flame, what does it do? It transmutes what matters to light. It burns upwards. And in its process, it liberates, purifies, and creates light. Mm-hmm. Well, to me, that's pretty simple. That if I want to find my own moral code that comes from a pure archetype rather than being dogmatized by some religion, the flame tells me. It tells me that it burns upwards. So lift my attentions to those which elevate me as a being. That which matters must transmute to create light. So how do I do that? Well, what happens is we digest life experience, and if we do it correctly, we gain wisdom. We get smarter. Mm-hmm. And in getting smarter, that also helps us to dissolve the patterns that are in the instinctual nature anyway. You know, like you learn to drive and it becomes instinctual. You don't even think about it. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it has its place. It's a good thing. But as anyone these days, all the patterns we have, they're all instinctual. Or Kabbalists would probably say yesodic. They're in that sort of astral subconscious flux. Well, that's the burning wick. And the more light we create from our experiences, the more wisdom we gain, the more we start transmuting our being, and we start to change. That's just a tiny little bit of it. How dynamic's that?
It's amazing, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, it constantly blows me away. You know, it's been years and years, and it the revelation of it never ceases to amaze me, just how dynamic it is. And the more you apply it, the more you contemplate it and apply it, the further it expands and the clearer it makes things. You know, it digests things. You know, things, if we consider the heat that the burn digest, one of the things that suggests to me is that we really have to have a passion about transmuting our stuff.
Now, in the past, I've sort of talked about alchemy in previous shows that I've done. But, you know, I would consider you a very well-versed and, you know, a teacher of this tradition. And I guess I want to start by asking your opinion about something, because you had alluded to this before we had actually started the recording the first time, and this is the idea, and this is not mine, of course, but this idea that nowadays people tend to sort of divide things into what you could call a spiritual alchemy and a practical alchemy. But there's the assertion that authentic alchemy really can't be divided because, you know, matter is essentially frozen spirit, if you will. What is your opinion of that?
I agree with you. Practical alchemy, my experiments went as far as making spaghetti tincture and a couple other little experiments with dew and placing a tincture in a crucible for a long time and watching what happened. But in that process, it explained a lot to me. And one of the things I've become to realize was that in the process of what we call practical alchemy, and there's certainly better operators of it than I, what happens is that one is releasing from the substance a quintessence, a life force within it. And within substance, if it's operated on correctly, must be produced a substance that not only can change physical state of a human being, but dramatically affect the consciousness. And what I've observed as well is that as one operates practical alchemy, if certain changes start to take place within the chemists themselves, then the potentiality of that to occur within the operation becomes greatly enhanced. I figure it's probably something like quantum physics, but not knowing a lot about quantum physics, you know, I can only assume. Now, when one understands just the basic spaghetti process, which generally is used for making a herbal tincture, and then you apply that to your own life, it really makes a lot of sense. Am I going in a reasonable direction here?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, well, let's look at the spaghetti process. We take a, let's say, a herb, let's say lemon balm.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's contained within, the virtue of the herb is contained within the leaf. So, to extract the virtue from the leaf, it goes through a chemical apparatus where what's called the essence is firstly extracted from the leaf through the medium of some form of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
That is like the, when you look at the plant, it's the green stuff in the leaf.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the male part. And that essence is highly vibratory. And what it leaves is just these parched leaves. There's no colour in them, they're white.
Mm-hmm.
So the next process is to take those leaves and then turn them to salt by setting fire to them, back to the candle,
mm-hmm.
and firing it a number of times and a number of ways to turn it to a very fine salt. Now that, the essence is the male part and the salt is the female part. And in order for the male to reunite with the female, she has to be burnt by fire because that's where his essence has been liberated and purified so that she can reunite with him. And when that salt is changed and reunited with the male part, it creates what's called a perfect medicine. Now, the leaf in itself, well, the female part of the leaf, is a certain structure and vibratory rate. When it turns to a salt, it's at a higher vibratory rate. Excuse me, all the matter and gross substance has been burnt off and it's just left its actual salts. Now, if we think about where we are, the leaf that contains our essence or our spiritual counterpart is within our personality and so forth, and the body, of course. The personality has a series of belief patterns and ideas that can be somewhat limiting and deluding.
Oh, yeah.
In order to... You got that one? So in order for, like, when we undergo some sort of spiritualizing process, there's a separation of the spirit and the personality. There's this high ideal and one, just like love, there's this high ideal and wonderful nature of being that elevates out of the world and out of the personality, and there's change for time, but then you've got to sort of come back and go, how do I fit this, and the old patterns get us, and on goes the story. Well, the fire in alchemy changes the body of the leaf, or the feminine part, to a higher vibration so it can unite and contain the male part. Am I making sense?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
So when we apply, what shall we call it, psycho-spiritual analysis on ourselves, when we work our way through our stuff, when we stop blaming and all the rest of that garbage we go through, and we start to get a handle on how we delude ourselves, how we manipulate, all those things that run us, as we start to get a handle on that, we start to change the pattern, the structure that contains the spirit. And as we start to purify the structure that contains the spirit, then the spirit can begin to unite with the new pattern, or the purified pattern, that contains it.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Now, having sort of got to that point, if you look at people that have hit the space, you know, all the guys that are relatively enlightened, there's a basic underlying archetypal pattern that appears in every one of them. You know, if you go to the big ones like Christ, Buddha, and all those guys, they all had incredible compassion.
Mm-hmm.
They all had a love. They all had a stillness. They were all pretty smart, and they generally spoke in parables or archetypal rhymes.
Mm-hmm.
Even gestures and ways they viewed things, there's a general pattern. They're not all exactly the same, but there's a basic pattern. Now, as we undergo this transformation process and we purify the salt, the patterns within the salt, as it becomes more and more purified, we start to adopt different behaviors that move closer to the archetypal pattern demonstrated by those that had really done it. Am I making sense?
Yes, definitely.
And this is alchemy. We're transforming our being.
Yeah.
And to me, at this point in time, although we need all sorts of remedies and things to change the physicality of things, that's the important part. That's the aspect of alchemy that's of greater importance.
Mm.
You know, if we get hit by a bolt of spiritual lightning and the personality doesn't go through a purifying process, you end up at Easter time with a heap of people walking down carrying a cross because they're Jesus incarnated or whatever. And unfortunately, you know, there's these people with the potential of hitting it, but the personality hasn't gone through the fire, so to speak, so it can reunite with that spirit. So the personality will grab onto whatever cultural archetype it can. Because, you know, delusions of grandeur, it wants to be better than itself, so it'll become Christ or Buddha or Elvis or whoever's the picture of the psyche.
Mm-hmm.
In the Hermetics, there's this thing where, you know, thrice great Hermes, and some initiates have come out and said, "I am Hermes." Well, in many ways, they're right, but in some cases, the personality has got caught within this pattern, and that's not to degrade their work or anything else. It's just a demonstration of the pattern. The fact is that Hermes is a pseudonym that every initiate takes, because all that any of us can ever be is a scribe. We can only ever be a messenger, because the one who sends the message is alive within every individual. It's all our own personal God.
Exactly.
And so, you know, that's the thing that I see so important with alchemy, is this process of transmutation. And if you consider, just if we just watch ourselves, how do we digest food? You know, we chew it over. Hopefully we have a good attitude before we start. We chew it over and then we swallow it. And the rest happens in this strange alchemic system within the body, and it turns to energy, and we can operate. So how do we do that mentally and emotionally? We chew it over.
Exactly.
Chew it over until we can't chew it over anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've got to swallow it or accept it. We don't have to do anymore. Once we accept it, it's in the process of transmutation. Now, what does that tell us of the power of acceptance?
Wow. It's, yeah.
Hey, what a dynamic. You know, this stuff's right under our bloody nose.
Mm-hmm. But usually takes someone to point it out to us, to make us see it and accept it, as you said.
So, you know, back to alchemy, if I apply that to the pattern of the flame and how it works, there it all is there. The blue-black flame is our mental-emotional principle. The white light above is our spiritual principle. The mental-emotional principle is between the spiritual principle and the instinctual principle. Depends on which way you look as to what you see. So if you seek the spiritual reality behind things, then your focus is moving into the light. If you get caught into the instinctual nature and you're surviving, then it moves into the wick. Now, if you get a wick, it doesn't radiate a lot of light, but the light radiates a huge circle.
Mm-hmm.
That's your awareness. The whole perception changes. Are you familiar with the Kabbalah?
I am, but not as much as I would like at this point.
Who is?
Right.
Chokhmah. You know where Chokhmah is on the Tree of Life?
Yes.
Okay, Chokhmah is wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a mountaintop. That's, well, a mountain. That's its one of its totems, Phallic Mountain. And there's all the associated ideas that come with wisdom and the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in I can never say this, so you'll have to probably help me here. Jesus did a thing called the Transfiguration, where he met with Moses and Elijah. I can never say, in 30 years, I've never been able to say it.
Mm-hmm.
On a mountaintop.
Right.
That's where he met his ancestors.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the process of the flame is the same process as death. You know, when the wick goes out, things change. And we move through this tunnel where we review, if we have consciousness, where we review our life. And in there is all our attachments. And this is the blue-black flame. That's where all our attachments are. And we go through this process of the tunnel. We go, well, I haven't completed this, and I really want to do that. And for my position, I want to surf more. And these things are our attachments that create the causal body for the potentials of our next incarnation. But we move towards the light. As we get closer to the light, if you can visualize the candle, as we get closer to where the blue-black flame merges with the white light, that's where we meet our ancestors or relatives, depending on our culture. On the top of the blue-black flame where it meets the light, that's where we meet the master or our God self.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you look at that blue-black flame where the white light sits upon it, that's a snow-covered mountaintop. You get the idea?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Images, yeah.
Well, that's another beauty of the video and stuff. that putting it in images is the only way really I can get it across.
Right.
I think. Now, if you consider the nature of Chokhmah, it says that Chokhmah rules the zodiac. Have you heard that?
That's right.
Now, the zodiac is four triplicities.
Right.
Which is a cross.
Mm-hmm.
That's the four elements. Malkuth, the kingdom, is basically the first home of the elements. Chokhmah rules the zodiac. Now, if you consider the body of the candle or the fat of the offering of the lamb upon the altar, which represents the four elements, what is being extracted by the fire, because in those rituals, Tetragrammaton came and devoured the offering by fire, is the essence, the quintessence. Can you get that picture?
Oh, yes, yeah.
Okay, now let's go back to the cross of four triangles. When you put a circle around that, that's an eight-spoked wheel.
Right.
Which is the Dharma of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Christ said, seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, or seek ye first Malkuth, which is a sanctified place.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha said, follow the path of Dharma, and you're at the point of transmutation. That's the kingdom. The four elements of such are, of course, our senses. I'm angry, I'm sad, I'm moody, I'm argumentative. They're the four elements within ourselves, and that's Tetragrammaton upon the body.
Okay.
Right? Yep. When we listen, and truly this is an amazing exercise, when you just listen to the environment intently, what happens, you'll find, is you'll come to peace. And listening is the throat. It's the throat chakra. The other four senses are from the throat down. And that creates a cross wherein the elements are at peace and the quintessence is beginning to be extracted. The flame is basically being lit. Above the throat are another two centers, the brow and the crown.
Mm-hmm.
So we have three centers relating to the spirit and four relating to the elements of our reality. The three centers of the spirit is the Hebrew letter Shin, which is the spirit of God. Now when you really listen with intent, the energy which descends on the head, you'll hear like a white noise sound when that really gets going. It's not that one's got tendonitis, it's the sound of the energy. This intense hissing sound, or maybe it's intense because I'm used to listening to it, but and the hissing sound is a hissing sound, isn't it? Shh sort of sound. What's the sound that fire makes?
The same.
And what's the sound of the serpent?
Exactly.
And I guess and the Hebrew letter Shin?
I was just going to say that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Same thing. Now, it's in Genesis it says, the Spirit of God, which is Shin, hovered over the waters of the deep, which is Mem.
Right.
And then God said, let there be light. Mem is the tarot card of the hangman.
Right.
In its shape is a triangle with a cross above it.
Mm-hmm.
Or a crucible where extracted from the cross of the elements is the quintessence.
Right.
Mem is the number 40, or four within a circle. Four within a circle is also Malkuth.
Right.
Seek ye first the kingdom. Now, what Mem is about, the hangman is about sacrifice. Mem has no sound. It's mute. So if we become really still, we become the waters of the deep.
Absolutely.
And then the Spirit of God hovers above, and the flame is lit.
I've never heard it explained quite that way before. That's marvelous.
Isn't it wonderful?
It is.
And it's so simple. it's a joke. I used to do this, I haven't done talks in town for a little while. I'm having a rest. But I used to light a flame from one source of flame to another. Now, the flame is Shekinah, the Spirit of God. Mm-hmm. And what's born of Shekinah is born of the Virgin. So every flame that I ignite is born of the Virgin, or is a Christ.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone that is turned on by the spirit of another, what has woken them is their own Christ self. Or call it, if someone has a problem with Christ, call it Buddha or whatever you want to give it a name as.
Mm-hmm.
But it wakes up.
Oh, indeed.
And when we start to look at things like that, all this separation and greater than thou can never get to it is within God, and all that stuff is within our grasp.
It's and right, I guess, there, yeah. It's right there.
I guess for me, the most important thing that if I ever get anything across to anyone is that it's within your grasp. It's not grander and greater than you. What could be greater than us? We are. It's just knowing.
And that makes all the difference. Yeah.
We probably got off the track a little there.
No, I think you were right on target, to be honest with you.
Wisdom is not gained from books, it's gained from ourselves, from going through the process and learning what makes us operate and how do we operate better.
Indeed.
And again, wisdom is the hardest for me, and maybe I'm just not very good with the public or passing things on that way, but it's the hardest thing to give away. It has no real glamour. And to partake in any form of wisdom, the personality has to be out of the way and just allow. While we're here, there's this simple little exercise that heals so much. You'd be in a conversation with someone and you get an insight as to say something. But oftentimes you say it and it doesn't get heard or it gets misunderstood and all the rest of it. If we just shut up and hold it. Now, if it's for the moment, it will stay. And by just being aware that it's there, what happens is the moment creates the opportunity, the perfect opportunity for you to express it. When there's no way that the person can avoid it, can create some sort of camouflage to run away from it, it's just there and it usually ends conversations. But by putting ourselves out of the way, one, we're disciplining the ego, but we're also surrendering more to the true self and allowing it to create the environment where it can express its seed. As I said, wisdom is ruled by Chokhmah, which has got the three or the four triangles in triplicity. Well, that's a clock, 12 around the clock, with the two hands of duality. And who is it that sits within the center of the 12 disciples? The true self. So timing, if we work with timing, at times, if you think about it, is elemental. It's how the elements materialize things, as in what we see as time is just an elemental clock. If we work with the timing of things, what we get is the spirit coming down and working its way through things. We get to discipline the personality, But we get to rejoice in the magnificence of the mystery. That's bloody good stuff to me. Any moment I can drink from that cup, I'm in there.
Oh, yeah.
Simple exercise. No daggers or swords or garments and circles. There's, well, there is a circle, but it's there. And without it, what do you got, eh?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, wow, it's just so profound. Paul, I really appreciate your time and all of these amazing pearls of wisdom that you've imparted to us tonight. I would very much like to speak with you again at some point in the future, if that's okay.
Anytime. It's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed myself.
Once again, I want to give your website out, which is spirituallife.com.au. And I would encourage people to check out your site and all of the material. There's a lot there for people to read and to view with the videos. And I'm going to link up some of those videos as well and put on the show notes so people can see them at my site as well as yours from the YouTube links. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity, you know, if you had any sort of parting thoughts or words that you wanted to leave the listeners with.
One word. Love.
Thank you.
God bless.